Hello and welcome back to the Talking Leadership TV podcast series. Thank you for joining us again. Today our guest is Mark Gostowski. Mark's been on the podcast before talking all things entrepreneurial leadership development. And today we're talking about challenges to developing our entrepreneurs. Mark's a proven C-suite executive with experience in building and supporting startups. He's worked extensively across the public and private sectors. He's led the development of government policy and programs and innovation precincts that support industry development and has also co-founded a number of startups in the tech, investment, and FMCG sectors. He's built national and international relationships that support Australian education and industry, and he's a passionate supporter of our industries, corporate innovation, entrepreneurship, and the tech space. He's led, designed, and delivered over 20 accelerator programs nationally. Mark's currently the founder and managing director of Innovation Architects, an innovation advisory firm, and co-founder and managing partner at Mandalay Venture Partners. I really enjoyed today's podcast. Thanks again for joining us, but enough from me. I'll hand over to Mark. Mark, thanks for joining me again and for agreeing to have a chat with me. This is our second discussion on the podcast, yeah?
Yeah, absolute pleasure to be here again, Eric, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too, mate. Look, one of the things I've decided to do this year and hopefully into next year is to sort of branch off into some areas that came up from the bulk of the podcast, which were audio discussions, and that's where we did our first discussion around entrepreneurship, and that as a theme is something I want to explore. So I'm looking at developing leaders and entrepreneurs, but I think for this discussion and for the sake on drawing on your extensive experience, I think we will focus on developing entrepreneurs. So as a introduction to the discussion, if I may, can I ask in broad terms, why is it important in your mind to develop entrepreneurs and an entrepreneurial bent?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, I come from the land of startups and founders and venture capital, and from where I see things, it's an interesting time we're in at the moment. In that we've got global economic climate sort of slowing down, yet inflation's high. When we look at the global downturns that we had in 2000, 2008, 2014, one of the key factors that brought the world out a lot of those economic downturns was entrepreneurship. And if you look at each of those economic downturns, we can see unicorn companies that sprouted right after those periods of time. And I think by continuing to develop entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship, we continue to build resilience in economies and ecosystems more broadly. But we're also looking at creating jobs for the future and industries for the future. And we're on the cusp of an AI wave at the moment that is going to change the way in which nearly all businesses operate. And by continuing to develop entrepreneurial thinking and entrepreneurial skills, as opposed to founders, which take a different subset of risk tolerances, it's important to be continuing to try and develop people that think differently, think outside of the square, and think in ways that can disrupt the status quo to the way many businesses operate. So whether that's taught in a school environment or, you know, in micro-credentialing or on the job, I think it's incredibly important to teach entrepreneurial thinking. It's something that we're seeing more and more of as we go. I'm actually delivering a workshop tomorrow for the City of Moreton Bay, who are delivering a number of initiatives and programs around entrepreneurship, but even for small businesses. So how do small business founders think more entrepreneurially to actually give themselves a leg up against their competitors? So I think it's something that we all need to do more of, and I think it's something that we're starting to see institutions and academic institutions think more clearly about now as well.
That's interesting scene setting there, and one of many questions that come to mind here is, from a foundational point of view, and I'll go back to the previous podcast question, are entrepreneurs born or are they made?
Yeah, I think you can teach the steps of entrepreneurship, and that by that I mean business building and building scalable businesses. The thing that I think is really hard to teach, and I'm not sure you can teach it, is you can sort of mold it and mature it, but I think it's very, very hard to teach, and that's a penchant for taking risk. So I think the penchant for taking risk with all of the founders that I've worked with seems to be a genetic trait that you can mold and you can shape, but it's very, very hard to teach risk tolerance. You can certainly teach the steps of entrepreneurship, and they're repeatable steps about building businesses and the steps you take to do that. But at the end of the day, the founders that put everything on the line, be that their house, salaries, relationships, in my mind, that's a genetic trait that is very, very, very hard to teach. It can be harnessed and honed, but it's very, very hard to teach. And I think that's what separates true founders from the rest of the pack, is that penchant to take risk when others won't.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that, and nor would I want to. But one thing that strikes me here is that when you're talking about the entrepreneurial mindset versus an entrepreneur themselves, that yeah, it's I'm trying to form the question here because I've got a few running around in my head, so I'll go to first principles here. There are competing schools of thought that yes, you can train entrepreneurs, and there's a school of thought that says no, you can't. You either have that risk tolerance or you don't, and that's something that can't be taught. From a foundational point of view, and again, I'm trying to build on some thinking here, if you'll indulge me, Mark, is schools, for example, where our young entrepreneurs live and breathe their lives before they go out into the big bad world, that do you believe from your experiences schools are geared up to understand what it is to support entrepreneurs? Because I'm going by my experience of school here, you either went down a path of you got out of school and went into a job, or you go to uni or you go to TAFE to get a trade, and that's about it. That fourth plank around starting your own business, being creative, being entrepreneurial, was not easy when I was in high school. This is going back 25 odd years. But with the advent of technology the way that it is, maybe that is less of a hurdle for kids and schools to deal with. But do so going back to the question, do you think schools are geared in this way to support that fourth tranche of business building and entrepreneurship, or is that a new space that people are playing in?
It's a really good question, and I think traditionally your standard school syllabus, whether it be high school or university syllabus, isn't well geared to really support entrepreneurial founders. Entrepreneurial founders historically have been mavericks. I mean, if you look at Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, others, they tend to have been mavericks that sit outside of the general school syllabus. They tend to resist general curriculum and forge their own pathways. And I think that's the traditional entrepreneur that we've seen, rise up through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. I think universities have started to try to do better. Certainly, I'm speaking in the Australian sense. The US universities, whether they be MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, even UCLA, are exceptionally good at this because they've got a proven track record. Now, I think the Australian university ecosystem is still struggling to really understand how to nurture an entrepreneur through a fixed 3 or 4 year course. I believe that there is generational change and opportunity that is coming to really help capture and teach entrepreneurs how to build repeatable and scalable businesses. But I don't think any of our universities have really cracked that code yet. We've seen a number of universities, University of Queensland, RMIT, run their own incubator and accelerator programs, and they're a really good start, but they sit outside of syllabus. They sit outside of core curriculum, so they're almost like micro-credentialed activities. I don't think we've seen any universities really embed true entrepreneurship into the syllabus. Swinburne started probably one of the first back in the early 2000s, where it had a Masters of Business Entrepreneurship as opposed to a Master of Business Administration. I think that was the start of something that was quite important. I don't think they really continued on with it in a way that they could have and should have. So I think the short answer to your question is no, I don't think it's being done well at the moment in Australia, but I think there is precedence overseas for it to be done quite well. The US is clearly the leader. And a lot of that is around how do we incentivize academics to be more entrepreneurial when, at the moment, across the Australian academic ecosystem, incentivization comes through publications and patents. And so there's no real incentive to spin out, nor do academics necessarily want to go and be business owners. So I think finding better ways to develop public-private relationships with technology transfer in academia is important. We see CSIRO having a good go at that at the moment through their company creation arm, which is headed up by Dean Ali and Anna Tao. And they're really looking at ways in which they can integrate research, spin out, and then bring in executive or entrepreneurship teams to run startups. That's something that I think has some credibility to it, but we're still in the very early stages of that. So I think the really agile universities will start to look at entrepreneurship syllabus more seriously. And I think that's going to come from the non-Group of Eight that have more flexibility and more agility to change the scope and syllabus. But we're still a long way from where, say, the Berkeleys and MITs and Stanfords, are at from the US. And that's really because we just haven't had the volume of success stories come out of university commercialization that the US has had.
Oh, okay. And that answers one of my questions around if there are successful models overseas, what is the resistance? And I could hazard a guess here that when you're talking about traditional academic pathways in university, as the big institutions that they are, it is about publication, it is about novel research, but not necessarily around setting up an entrepreneurial venture. And I would be curious, and I am curious around this, is to what extent are existing entrepreneurs lured to gain academic research credentials to get into the system to change it from within versus the universities actually actively seeking them out? And if that's still not being done to the extent that you might think it needs, and I would agree with you that it's important to at least be considering, is maybe the tension there between what a university is meant to do versus the core of what an entrepreneurial mindset is, qualitatively distinctive, as in maybe they don't come together well, and maybe there are reasons for that in traditional institutions. And when you talk about finding opportunities in a system, maybe there will be university in the future or a startup uni that focuses solely in that area, because I would think that the grant money available and the opportunity to pair with industry is important. But even that, the discussion that you bring up, and it's a fascinating one around pairing universities with entrepreneurs, there's still the go to the other way is how do you get entrepreneurs interested in that world and then vice versa, and
Yeah,
what's the block there?
I'm not sure. So time is the
Okay.
block. So anyone that wants to start a business and has true entrepreneurial flair is not going to put themselves through 4 years of study, because by the time that period is up, economies have moved on, technology adoption has changed, and so much has changed. So the 3 and 4 year cycle of getting a bachelor's degree or a postgraduate degree just doesn't work for those that are looking to start businesses. And that's why we saw a lot of the universities kick off incubator programs and accelerator programs, because they were more, short course, 3, 6 month type activities that allowed for get in, get out quickly. Now, the thing that attracted a lot of entrepreneurs that were probably not embedded within the academic sphere to participate in those accelerators was money. So they often came with money. I know the one that we used to run at Creative Enterprise Australia was an accelerator program that had between $20,000 and $50,000 attached to it for the entrepreneur to help build and grow their business. And that was a 12-week accelerator. So a short period of time, come in, learn a lot, meet mentors, meet founders, understand business modeling, get some small amount of seed capital, and then, excuse me, and then go to market. The accelerators that don't have that capital incentive tend not to attract the best entrepreneurs. Because they'll spend their time elsewhere trying to find capital. And so one of the big hindrances, I think, for traditional university courses is time. No one has time to wait around 3 or 4 years before they want to launch a business. That's where I think a lot of the universities at the moment are leaving a lot on the table by not really diving into micro-credentialing, where they can provide short, succinct blocks of education, almost like an a la carte opportunity, And that's the tension and the struggle that I guess has been existing with the universities over the last decade is the relevance that they might be having or losing to the general population. And so how, you know, whether you're, if you want to study law, medicine, yes, it's absolutely understandable that you need to have those entrenched learnings. But where you've got entrepreneurial business opportunities, often time is a limitation. You don't have time, you know. The world was a very different place, Eric, 4 years ago than it is today. And if you'd started a business in 2019, if you started a course in 2019 to learn how to build a business, what you learned would probably be redundant today, although it doesn't seem that long ago. So time is a really big issue and a big factor, which is why I think the micro-credentialing, micro-learning is the way to go if academic institutions want to get involved in nurturing entrepreneurship more.
So, as an extension to that discussion, if I can, Mark, and you use the word ecosystems here around creating that network and that opportunity for people to build their businesses and learn from others and engage in that space of mutual learning and reinforcement and so on. I guess, to what extent has that helped in the creation and the development of entrepreneurs versus going out on your own and giving it a go? I mean, is it understood amongst those with an entrepreneurial bent, entrepreneurship being in their system, that ecosystems are out there for them to engage with, or
Yeah,
is
I
it
think
is
it's.
it is it is it something that they have to discover through chance?
Well, I think the visibility of innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystems has significantly increased since 2016. You know, the advent of co-working spaces and accelerators and incubator programs has helped build that ecosystem. Having said that, I think your tier one founders, so you know, from an Australian perspective, maybe Luke Kinnear from Safety Culture and you know, Cam and Co at Canva and others, they would have made it regardless of the ecosystem that exists, I suspect. It's the next tier down that need the peer support, the mentor support, to keep going and to keep striving that really benefit from strong innovation ecosystems. And they may not be successful in their first or their second, but it might be the third and onwards that where they're successful. And so I think we've seen, you know, at state government levels, Launch Vic and the hubs in Victoria, we see the hubs in New South Wales, the Sydney Startup Hub. I think these are really important places for entrepreneurs and innovators to congregate and to find their tribe. And finding your tribe is really important. You know, being an entrepreneur is already a small subset of the general populace, and so it's quite hard to find those that share the passions, drivers, and understandings that you have. So I think that's where these ecosystems are incredibly important. And, you know, we saw in Victoria in the early 2000s the development of the Bio21 precinct, you know, in the Melbourne region that led to the synchrotron and whatnot. These are big pieces of physical infrastructure that brought people together in the medtech space. And Melbourne is now, you know, potentially a world leader in many areas in biotech. I think those sorts of investments are important to bring people together, and we're starting to see, you know, maybe generation two or even three of these ecosystems and what they look like. The challenge with many of these ecosystems is that they're not sustainable because of what they do, which is not necessarily revenue generating. It's bringing people together, and so they always do tend to require some type of government intervention to really support and kick those things off. If it's not government intervention, it's membership intervention through groups like maybe Startup Victoria. And so these ecosystems are important to really drag, you know, the 90% of people through that need the support and the peer support. But as I said, there are outliers, you know, that we see, whether it be Atlassian or Canva or Safety Culture or GoOne, where I think you've got exceptional founders that would succeed regardless of what's around them.
Interesting. And I would ask you, how connected are these ecosystems around the country? Are they networked together, or do you find that they work in isolation?
Good question. I would probably suggest they tend to work in isolation, and that is in part because of how they're funded and financed. So if you look at, you know, Lot 14 in South Australia, or the Victorian hubs and Launch Vic down at Docklands, or the Sydney Startup Hub, they're funded by state governments and state government bodies. State government bodies are notoriously competitive with each other in Australia. We tend not to operate as a country. We tend to operate as separate states from a funding perspective, and it would be rare to see those those hubs working closely or aligned in any way, shape, or form. Where we see those borders being crossed is where you have industry-specific conferences that might move between the various states. So an example of that would be Evoke Ag, which was a big ag tech and food tech conference that was in Perth this year. It's going to be in Brisbane next year. These sorts of events bring together tribes and groups of people with similar and like interests. In this case, ag tech and food tech. And these are the sorts of things that bring people together more than those probably state-funded ecosystems where there's competitive tension that remains. And so those sorts of large events tend to bring these groups together. Having said that, Eric, I would love to see Australia operate more collaboratively, for a global competition rather than state-based competition. We've been talking about this for 30 years, probably. Australia competing against each of the states competing against each other when they go to international events, and it's something that would be nice if it was broken down. But it's sort of, it's an outcome of the way a lot of the state funding and the federal funding happens. So I'm not sure it's ever going to be fixed. But it's up to the innovators, the entrepreneurs, and those that have specific industry interests to pull together. And I think we're starting to see that, particularly in the blockchain and distributed ledger space. There's a lot of groups now coming together and holding and bringing groups together. Steve Vallis, who runs Blockchain APAC, is an exceptional example of bringing groups together from all over the country. He was formerly the CEO of Blockchain Australia, moved into Blockchain APAC, and runs events and brings communities together across the whole country. And that's the sort of stuff that needs to be done. And people like Steve Vallis are the sorts of people that should really be rewarded for the amount of effort they put into to actually bring community together.
Yeah, 100%. I like the fact that someone has seen that missing link in the system and just gets in and does it themselves. I don't think government will ever drive it, and it's mind-boggling to me that we don't have more of a collegiate approach to that across the states. But I understand the government tension and the competitiveness, because once you grow an entrepreneurial base, you want it to be based in your state, not another state. And to have the discussion around let's share those outcomes is going to go absolutely nowhere. I think because essentially, if the state is using public monies to help these things move along, then they have to be accountable for what is the return on investment for the state. And if I'm hearing you right, the return on investment on a national basis is we get a lot more competitive and we're creating jobs across the entire economy rather than in one particular state. But the fact that that hasn't been cracked over 30 years, I'm not going to do it in a podcast with you. If we had the solution, mate, that would be great. But
Well, look,
I
I
think
think
we're going to.
state intervention, state by state based intervention is still essential because the Australian innovation flywheel isn't complete. We have big gaps in capital at the early stage. We have gaps in capital at the growth stage. We don't have a lot of second or third generation venture funds that have been through it before and understand acquisition markets and secondary markets and follow on opportunities and whatnot. So the government intervention is incredibly important. It helps the flywheel. It fills gaps that don't exist. We've seen what happens when government intervention moves away across Victoria or Queensland. Activity stops. And so it's very important, but it does then create a competitive tension. But having said that, I think Queensland is doing a really good job at the moment, particularly through the VCDF, Venture Capital Development Fund. Victoria, through LaunchVic, has done a good job over the last decade in supporting startups. It would be nice to see more venture capital flowing into the early stage and more founder support. I think we went through a bit of a period of accelerators being the darling child of the startup ecosystem, probably between 2016 and 2020, 2019, and then they really fell away. And so it's nice to see accelerator activity slowly starting to pick up again, because that's really sort of that's the manufacturing hub for entrepreneurs and startups. And so it's part of the important flywheel that exists that we need to continually generate new entrepreneurs, new startups, new founders to grow the economy. And so that activity is incredibly important.
Does the federal government play in this space, or is it really more a state and local government arena?
A lot of the startup program activity is generally state-based activity. The federal government has a lot of support in the grant space. So Probably the most important one is the R&D tax concession or tax rebate that exists for startups, and that's incredibly important. It's the lifeblood for many startups. We've got things like the National Reconstruction Fund that's sort of popped up and is a fairly large pool of money. It's not necessarily for startups, but down the supply chain, they might be benefit of that. There was the accelerating commercialization grants at a federal level that were also incredibly important. And then there's a lot of state-based grants, although they tend to be smaller than the federal grants. So yeah, the feds do play a role, but probably less of a role programmatically. We've seen Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, or DFAT, get more and more involved, probably in the last couple of years than they ever have been previously in terms of supporting startup program activity. And that's very, very interesting because that starts to create linkages into international markets. But again, a lot of the activity, state, local, federal, is unaligned. And it would be nice to see sort of a greater degree of alignment across the board, so that advantages you can have the multiplier effect instead of sort of jumping from one to the other without that. But having said that, tough times economically now, and I think any support is good support for the ecosystem.
I have a feeling, no research to back this, that if it was to happen, it's going to be pushed by entrepreneurs themselves, not by the government. And the fact that it's still not aligned speaks volumes about whether or not there is a collective vision for what entrepreneurship means in the country. And I've had this series of questions in my head for quite some time around. Do we really have a business culture and a community culture that is supportive of entrepreneurs? And is it qualitatively different to, say, the US? Because if institutions, like you said, the institutions you mentioned in the US, the universities are in this space and doing it exceptionally well, is it because there is a drive for entrepreneurship in the American psyche that we just don't have? And is that a factor that we can't mitigate against, whether or not your culture is for the development of entrepreneurs and the businesses that they might create?
Yeah, I think entrepreneurship is certainly celebrated more in the States than it is here. And I think embedded across the wider corporate ecosystem, entrepreneurship is more supported. So it's very hard to name large Australian industries that would voluntarily or regularly donate capital, time, and whatnot to startups and entrepreneurs. Whereas in the US, you see that regularly. In the US, there's a program called the SBIR program, something like Small Business Innovation Research, where all of the key federal departments commit, I think it's almost 1%, so it's a considerable amount of their capital to entrepreneurship, startup activity, and startup engagement. We just don't have that here. We just don't have that sort of commitment across our whole, I'll use the word again, flywheel. It's incredibly hard to get Australian corporates to invest in the ecosystem. You look across most of Southeast Asia, and 80% of the capital comes through corporate venture, and only about 20% comes through, standard venture capital or families. Whereas here, it's the opposite. 80% of venture comes through venture capital funds, small funds, family offices, and very, very little through corporate venture. And that's something else, that comes down to, the Australian psyche, is that there's a lack of competition across our corporate landscape that really, really means there's no true drive for accelerated innovation and accelerated thinking across the entrepreneurship space. You go into say a market like Thailand, every bank has a venture arm, an active venture arm, because there are so many banks and so much competition that they have to do that. Every telco, has a venture arm. You look at Thailand, True Digital Park, which is almost 20 acres of innovation space, was built by a telecommunications company to act as an attractor for entrepreneurship, innovators, and ecosystem. We just don't have that here. We don't have that level of commitment at the corporate level. So again, an area as to why government needs to intervene more than what it does in other areas is because we just don't have that investment at a corporate level or at a government level. Even government processes, we talk often about the best type of capital to get into a startup is a customer's capital. That's sales. Governments have been talking about preferred procurement for startups for a long, long time. It just hasn't eventuated for any number of reasons. So things like SBIR in the US are really important because it does inject that capital back into the startup ecosystem. I think that's something that we really haven't seen at a federal level, a strong innovation policy since the Turnbull government. And that's quite a while back now, if you think about it, and it didn't go so well. So innovation, entrepreneurship, startups tends to be sort of one of the first agendas that falls off the political items when elections roll around. Just happens to be the case in Australia that it always seems to be the case that innovation and entrepreneurship falls off first. It doesn't win votes, and unfortunately, we don't necessarily get the ecosystem doesn't necessarily get its voice heard. I think we hope that would change through a couple of the new institutes that have been put together. But let's see. I think we still have a ways to go across getting the federal government aligned to having an Australia-based innovation policy that we can work towards, and then each of the states can work towards. I don't think we've really had that for quite some time.
I want to ask here, I guess, in terms of the move forward with some of this is in this space, and I'll ask this this way actually, and let's go to some demographics here. What is the if is there an average profile of an entrepreneur in Australia? Are they typically small business in focus? Are they medium business? Are they something else? And why I ask this is that entrepreneurs usually are building a business of some kind, and given the importance of small business and medium business to the economy, I would think that the entrepreneurs fit in that space, that's may fall under that rubric. So the amount of focus that government put on the small business community, is it a branding issue, or is it that?
No, I think there's some pedantics around the wording, certainly. Small businesses are incredibly important, and they're the powerhouse of the Australian economy, no doubt about that. But small businesses generally are called small businesses because of their lack of ability to scale at speed. And I think when you talk about entrepreneurship and startups, you're talking about founders that have the ability to build businesses that can scale at speed and at pace, and leverage technology for growth, and then do that over and over. So inherently, entrepreneurship is a—it's a talent. It's almost a disease that requires someone to build businesses over and over and over. Like, you have that in you. You must keep going and building over, and that's what entrepreneurship is. A business owner is great. A business owner is, and a small business owner is wonderful. You can build a wonderful small business or medium-sized business and do it once and grow that one business. Entrepreneurship and startups, and I think that the pinch of an entrepreneur is to want to do that over and over and over many times. And you mean, there's a reason there are so few on the planet, that you'd call, true entrepreneurs, Elon Musk being one of them, regardless of whether you agree with his political alignment, has built multiple billion-dollar businesses over and over and over. And so I think that's the trait of an entrepreneur, is they want to continue to do it over and over and over.
Outsider looking in, that the contribution that a small business community makes is one discussion. The contribution of the entrepreneur that can be helped to build and scale time and again is going to have some positive economic implications for the country longer term. And yeah, it baffles me that we're not more into this space, as in from government support. And you can imagine what those entrepreneurial ecosystems would look like if governments at all levels committed 1% of
Oh, I
their
mean,
budgets to that endeavor.
you only need to look at what's probably going to happen next year when Canva list on the stock exchange, when they do a dual listing, whether it's on the NASDAQ and the ASX or other. They're going to create billionaires overnight. Now, by overnight, we say over 20 years, but the listing itself will create billionaires overnight. There's about $1.5 billion of capital, I think, that will be released into the market when Canva list. Now, yes, that's going to put house prices up in Double Bay and Woollahra for sure, but that's going to release an enormous amount of capital for people that made money in a technology company that are wanting to reinvest in technologies. And so this is part of the flywheel in Australia that hasn't existed. And the Canva listing is incredibly important because it's going to release capital that's going to flow absolutely back into the startup ecosystem. And we haven't really had many of these critical events that bring capital back into the startup ecosystem in recent times. And so supporting entrepreneurs, startups, and entrepreneurship activity, whether it be an Atlassian or a Canva or a GoOne or a Safety Culture, these are recycling events that allow capital to return back into the ecosystem. And that's why supporting entrepreneurship is incredibly important.
For those that might be listening, can you give us a sense of who Canva is?
Yeah, so Canva is a company that started by Cameron Adams, Melanie, and there's a third founder probably 12 or 15 years ago that allows you to do, well, it started off as calendars, school calendars and things like that, and then allows you to create your own artwork for events and invitations and posters, and now has integrated AI and machine learning and is just an incredible tool for graphics and creatives and designers. And anyone can use it from, a mum and dad to very sophisticated creative agencies. And so, Canva's really changed the face and the way in which people can engage and interact and create content. It's got lots of investors, all the big VC funds, from the early days are in there. And there's going to be a lot of capital released into market once they list, and there's liquidity. And so it's an exciting time for the Australian startup ecosystem for when that does happen. The rumors being it's going to be next year, but we'll see. But it will release and return a significant amount of capital into the ecosystem that will be recycled. And I think, come 25, 26, 27, a lot of that capital will be flowing back into the startup markets. And that timing will be wonderful for our ecosystem.
Yeah, that's some good news. So, final question here, Mark, and it's a two-parter. First being, give me a issue that you see on the horizon that will be a challenge for the development of our entrepreneurs, and then can you give me a big opportunity that's coming for the development of our entrepreneurs from an Australian perspective?
So the biggest challenge for entrepreneurs, all and this goes on both sides. So capital allocators and fund like Mandalay, which we have, or startup founders, is that capital is very, very hard to come by right now. There's a number of reasons for that. Interest rates are high, so people that have capital find putting money into either debt or into fixed term deposits is a positive return for them. Getting anywhere between 6 and 12%, and so that's competition for allocators. Capital allocators and for people trying to raise funds, because you go to a family office and they might want to put all of their money into debt because debt's returning at 12 or 15%. That's competition for venture funds, that's competition for startups. And so raising money right now is very, very challenging across the board. The flip side of that is because money is very competitive, valuations for capital allocators are great. So the valuations of companies that might have been up in the let's say $50 million in 2022, 21, 22 might be as low as $20, $25 million now, sometimes less. So we're seeing really good valuations across the board because of the challenges of raising capital. But those that have capital on hand are being very careful in their deployment of it. So there are opportunities on both sides there. One is that there are great valuations. There's never been a better time to invest in startups than right now. Because of the valuation period that we're in. And we've probably got 12 to 18 months of this down valuation cycle to make great bets into the market. Challenges are there are only a few people sitting on dry powder, and those few have lots and lots of options and opportunities. And interest rates and debt markets are a big competitor to venture right now. And so it is a challenge. It is very, very hard on both sides of the table.
Thank you for your time and the conversation, mate. This has been great.
Absolute pleasure, Eric, anytime, and thanks for having me.
For those listening or watching the program, thank you for joining me again. Have a great day, rest of your week, and we'll catch everyone on the next episode of Talking Leadership TV.